MSW Media.
Prevail, це щотижнева програма про політику.
L'histoire, la sécurité nationale.
Crimine organizzato, dinero sucio.
Глобальну корупцію та боротьбу за демократію.
E ora?
А тепер?
E maintenant?
Con ustedes, su anfitrión.
Grégoire.
Welcome to the fight. This time I know our side will win.
I'm Greg Oliar. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. We've got a great show. Alex Aronson is here. Alex is the former chief counsel to Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, who is also on my show. He worked on judicial ethics, oversight, and dark money issues, and he advised on the Supreme Court confirmation hearings of Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett. He wasn't there yet for Gorsuch. He missed that joy. But he was there for the other two. So he had a real front row seat to lots of stuff that went on. He has a lot of opinions, obviously, about all the Supreme Court fuckery that we're going to get into. One quick note. We recorded this last Tuesday. It was June 27th and before the Supreme Court released all those wretched decisions last week. So we knew they were coming, but we didn't know about them yet. So we don't cover those. Which is fine. It was the day that the first Leonard Leo piece that I wrote came out. I wrote the second one on Tuesday. If you're interested in this stuff at all, please go to my Prevail Substack and read about Leonard Leo. I did a two-part deep dive, man in the middle, about him and all of his connections. He is, if you don't know, people unaware, Leonard Leo is the man most responsible for the overturning of Roe v. Wade because he packed the court, man. And I went really into the weeds with this. So please read that, share it. I think one thing that we can do to help this dire situation is to make Leonard Leo famous. And as I said on the 5-8 on Friday, he has the most villainous villain name of all villain names, Leonard Leo. I mean, it sounds like something from like an old Batman comic. It's a memorable name. It's a name easily associated with villainy. So, you know, everybody's got to know who this guy is. That's the best thing that we can do. Alex and I talk about a lot of things. Before we started, I kind of read him through some questions and he was like, we're never going to finish all this in an hour. But we did. We got through it in almost exactly an hour. Great conversation. Always wonderful to talk to him. He knows so much stuff and, you know, and ultimately is a hopeful guy. So that's the thing that I like the best is that, you know, in addition to all this great knowledge that he has, he really has a lot of hope for us that it's not all lost, which is wonderful and which we need, you know, because it's not. We have the numbers. Now, having said that, there are times, I don't know, you know, LB and I have this running joke about simulation and stuff like that. And I don't really think there's a simulation, but you look around sometimes at all the shit that's happening. You know, there's these stories about climate change that are just, I mean, if you ever stop and like read these stories, you know, like not scroll through the headlines, but just go read the stories about the climate change. And it's really bad, like really bad. And it's getting to the point now where obviously you look out at the weather and the weather's completely fucked up everywhere. You know, Texas a couple weeks ago was the hottest place on earth. It was like 107 degrees for a week in a row. The governor there can't even keep the fucking power on because he's so inept. You know, here in New York, we still, on certain days, can smell the smoke from the Canadian wildfires, which I can't even imagine, you know, what it's like to be in Canada. I mean, closer to it. It's just awful. So everything literally smells like fire and brimstone right now. And so you got that. You've got AI, which I think, I don't know, even 6 months ago was still, you kind of thought AI, you thought about the Spielberg film, you know, with Haley Joel Osment. And now it's suddenly, like really suddenly everywhere. AI's going to do this and AI's going to do that and AI's going to do this. And, you know, we have an entire body of work in science fiction warning about the dangers of AI. I mean, almost every sci-fi book that covers it warns about it. It's not something that people take lightly or think is going to be great for the most part. It's always the same story in these books. Some, you know, hubristic, money-hungry genius thinks it's wonderful, and then everything gets ruined because of AI. That's basically the plot of every AI thing that ever AI'd. Now, that's out there. Okay, so you've got the climate disaster that makes certain places on the planet look like actual hell. You've got AI. You've got aliens, you know, and these UFO. There's a new term for UFO. I can't remember what it is. It doesn't matter. You know, government agencies doing actual things on Congress talking about spotting aliens and seeing these alien ships that nobody can explain. Nobody even talks about it at all, And, you know, the best and the brightest that we have to offer, meanwhile, on planet Earth are like, all we talk about is like Trump and Elon Musk, two of the fucking dumbest, most least interesting people that have ever existed. And I don't know. I wonder if humanity is in this place where, you know, in Goodfellas, where he's, you know, he's going through and he's got to go to the house and make the meatballs, and then he's got to get the cocaine and he's got to drive to Pittsburgh and all this kind of stuff. And then, you know, he's driving and he's all strung out and he looks up and the helicopter's there. I wonder if humanity is like at that point, you know, that we're at whatever simulation we're in. Are they going to come rescue us? Is this the point at Lord of the Flies where the grown-ups show up on the island? I don't know. You know, I'm laughing about it, and I don't really believe all of that. I think it's just, you know, something that happens. But my God, you know, if you were to take a look at all this stuff and say, okay, what would be the signs of the coming apocalypse? You know, if you're playing apocalypse bingo, you would have cashed out by now. That's all I'm saying. So, yeah, it's we really do need to fix the fucking court so that we can have freedom, so that we can go address all these issues before, you know, the world becomes uninhabitable. Probably an important thing. I'm just saying. You know, it's July. It doesn't even feel like July. The weather's been very strange. What can I say? These are the thoughts that I've been having. So anyway, I hope everybody had a great 4th of July. We're coming on the 250. We're coming on the 250 of July 4th, of Independence Day. I know, you know, bicentennial means 200 years and sesquicentennial means 150 years. So I'm assuming that the 250 is the bisesquicentennial. Which feels appropriate. I think headline writers are going to have fun with that when the time comes. So, yeah, I got nothing else. We'll be right back with Alex Aronson.
Three fingers to Santis is a big fascist asshole. Spends money on lawsuits while the state is flat broke. He kidnapped some migrants, sent them to Martha's Vineyard. He vilifies teachers, he says they're too woke.
We reject woke ideology.
Weirdo DeSantis laughs like a hyena, wears heels on his floor chimes to make him more tall. The prisoners at Gitmo complained of abuses. What did he see there? He doesn't recall. Tres dedos de Santis es un grande fascista, es un grande pendejo, and his wife is one too. He won't protect trans kids and their parents and doctors. Don't vote for DeSantis, make Florida blue.
Florida is where woke.
Alex Aronson, welcome to Prevail.
Hey, Greg. Thanks so much for having me.
So you were, for a while, the general counsel for my favorite senator, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse. And that sounds, you know, when you go to your bio page anywhere, that's a very snazzy thing to have on one's resume. But before we begin and delve into the many, many things that we have to talk about, because before we turned the camera on or the recorder on, we went through quickly all the questions. You were like, there's no way we're going to get to any of this in an hour. I do want to go through a little bit of your background. So
How do you get a job like that? And what does it involve, like, on the day to day? What did you spend your time doing?
Sure. Well, for me, it was, I think, largely a stroke of good fortune and good timing. But, you know, my background was as a organizer, of course, as a lawyer. I was a civil rights lawyer at the time I made my way to the Senate working at the Justice Department. So, you know, I had a substantive issue kind of expertise that was in line with what, you know, the senator was working on in the Senate Judiciary Committee, and that was he was going to be called upon to really lean into as we turned into the Trump era. I joined him in the spring of 2017 as the kind of Trump judge conveyor belt really started getting rolling, and as the kind of, assaults on the rule of law from the Trump Justice Department really started becoming clear. So that was kind of how I made my way in. And then, you know, the day-to-day of the job was, you know, exhilarating, equal parts, I'd say exhilarating and maddening. You know, we were in the minority the whole time. And, you know, of course, the news was just, you know, flying left and right. And,
yeah.
You know, with each news story kind of seemingly falling further and further into the breach of the kind of lack of precedent for what we were seeing from the Trump administration. So happy to kind of dig into any of the details of what the work looked like. But yeah, it was pretty wild to be there.
So how closely did you work with the senators across the aisle, as they say in Washington? Did you get to know a lot of these people, or was it more like internal to your own camp?
Well, I would say I worked with them a little bit. I worked with their staffs pretty extensively, and I was around them all the time. You know, you're, you know, in the business meetings, the markups and the hearings that the committee had. I was in close proximity to them, which, you know, for somebody like me, it took a toll. I had, you know, I would sit behind Senator Whitehouse at the dais, you know, the Judiciary Committee, and where we were positioned. The Republican senators would come in from the ante room right behind me and sort of file past the senators right between me and the senators. And so they would, you know, come very close to me, and I would have to resist my urge to trip them because they would just, you know, they would just, particularly during this era, and they haven't stopped, you know, just engage in such obviously bad faith politics and such egregious displays of, you know, partisanship and bad faith that it was hard for me to restrain myself at times.
I think you should get some sort of Congressional Medal of Honor, although that's one of the things that Trump has cheapened by his presence, one of the many things he's cheapened by his presence. So have you, you know, you were in proximity to Ted Cruz. Did you ever see him look into a mirror and there was no reflection there, or is that just a rumor?
You know, I tried to take a look every time he passed past the kind of, you know, mirrored doors, but yeah. it was a great privilege to get to work there and have that job, but being in close proximity to Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley and Lindsey Graham are one of the things that I do not miss.
Yeah, I could see that being, you know, I always say, you know, when I die and go to hell, right after they hand me the hazelnut coffee and then .. whatever it is, you know, Ted Cruz will just be walking by me within tripping distance forever. I don't know. Would be a kind of thing on his way to meet the boss, you know, his right. Boss will be like, good job, Ted. So, okay. Now, Senator Whitehouse is great about, you know, talking about dark money and really sort of shining a light on all of these, you know, this network of influence that exists in DC, which I've tried to cover and write about a lot on my site, on Prevail, on my Substack, and especially with Leonard Leo and stuff like that. But one of the, I guess, kind of the starting point for, not for all of it, but for how this current incarnation of problems happens is Citizens United. And I think that's something that even for me, I'm talking about now for me, you know, I talk about it and I know what it means in a vague sense, but talk a little bit about Citizens United, about the decision, like, what is it really? What does it mean? How did they justify making the decision? And that kind of thing. Because I think that's a big thing that we're kind of up against in this daily struggle that we have.
Yeah. Thanks. I think that's a really important case to start with. And I think it's a good one that you picked. You know, and it falls, you know, as it falls in as part of what was really a coordinated 50-year scheme on the part of the conservative legal movement and their billionaire backers to infiltrate and capture the federal judiciary and our governmental institutions writ large. And of course, money and politics was a huge part of that plan, because they knew they could outgun us if they could open the floodgates. Citizens United was a response by interest groups, by right-wing interest groups in the Republican Party to the significant sweeping reforms of the McCain-Feingold bipartisan campaign finance bill. And in that case, they were really gunning for the limits on independent expenditures in campaign politics. And in reaching the constitutional holding that the First Amendment prohibited that expenditure limit because money is speech, the court, I think really, really advanced this agenda on the part of these right wing interests. And a big part of what they did in justifying that ban, that First Amendment ban, which, of course, is largely unattached from textualism or originalism, the kind of twin philosophies of interpretive methodology that the conservatives sort of say they apply to constrain their policy preferences. They really pointed to the bill's disclosure provisions as a check on corrupting influences. They said, well, these independent expenditures can't be corrupting because we're going to know who's paying for them. And, if you see the politician in question doing favors for the person who made the expenditure, you'll see that would be a corrupt exchange. And so that will deter the type of corruption that you reformers are concerned about. And of course, after reaching that holding, we've seen this, decade-long assault on disclosure, which is, right, still ongoing and which has made significant strides. It's people like Mitch McConnell, who in the context of Citizens United said, disclosure's great, it's going to save us here, have been waging a war against disclosure, because now that they've got unlimited corporate spending in politics, they want unlimited anonymous corporate spending in politics, so that they can not only kind of unleash this tidal wave of corruption and special interest influence on our politics, but really achieve the same results without even having to spend. They can really just hang the threat of expenditures over these politicians' heads.
That's an interesting point. The disclosure thing strikes me as important, because even I wrote today in the thing in my piece, from a national security standpoint, shouldn't we know where the money's coming from that comes into these campaigns and goes into these politicians, campaigns' pockets? Because if we don't know, if there's no way to find out, I don't know that the money's not coming from Putin or China or whoever, pick your bad guy. I think the onus should be on Leonard Leo, for example, to tell us where his money's coming from, so we know that it isn't tainted. It just seems to make sense to me, but.
And frankly, the reasoning of the Citizens United opinion would tend to support that. there's an interesting kind of, I wouldn't call it a wave yet, but there's some promising developments in places like Washington and Minnesota, which are starting to pass laws that limit acceptance of foreign money in politics. So it'd be interesting to see how those cases get litigated. I think, you put your finger on a really important concern about the risk of foreign influence, especially, now that we know, from investigations like, Mueller's, that there are foreign efforts to interfere in our politics.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, here's a question. This wasn't even on my list, but I'm going to ad lib here. I'm going to pivot, because this is something that nobody's been able to really fully explain to me. And I've asked a lot of different kinds of people. So people say, oh, well, Kyrsten Sinema's getting money from these right-wing people, whatever. She's getting money from the No Labels. She's getting money from, what's his name? Harlan, I don't know if it was Harlan Crow or Barry Said, one of these billionaires, sort of these rat fucker campaign people. But when the average American thinks that they're getting money from so-and-so, they think that they really are getting money. Like, here's a pile of money. Don't spend it all in one place. And of course, it doesn't really work like that. There are, I think, pretty strict laws on what exactly the money can buy. But it clearly, they use it somehow. It isn't just to keep them in power, right? I mean, I guess my question is, how much of this dark money donations and other things can someone like a Lauren Boebert actually use? Can Joe Manchin go buy his Maserati and claim it on his as a campaign expense? Like, how does that work, I guess?
No, I wouldn't think that he could do something like that. But it gets to this question of like, what is corruption, right? It again, it comes back to the court. And this has been a bipartisan issue at the court that has, you know, across party lines, defined corruption so narrowly that kind of in the legal context, like corruption is quid pro quo corruption. Like, you know, here's a bag of money, you go do this bad act. But we know from just like being people in the world that that's not the end of it, right? Corruption can look like a lot of things. And so, you know, when we have, you know, billionaires providing luxury lifestyles to nominal public servants like Supreme Court justices, and if we had similar arrangements with elected officials, you can understand how, you know, that provides an incentive, it provides a reward structure to continue to deliver results that those big money donors want. And so, sure, I mean, I think that is happening, you know, across all sorts of contexts within our politics. And it largely connects to the kind of very loose and lax ways in which, you know, our laws have kind of approached this question of corruption.
Yeah. And of course, on the Supreme Court, there really isn't anything to guide anything. There's no ethics rules, as we know. And Clarence Thomas sought counsel from somebody, maybe probably Scalia, who was like, yeah, fuck it, do it. Why not? There's nothing that says that you can't. So have at it. It seems to me that the corruption on the court is really stunning. I mean, I don't know what I thought was going on, but when the story broke about Clarence and Ginni Thomas, the story in ProPublica and Harlan Crowe just underwriting so much shit for these two, it was really just jaw-dropping. Like I couldn't, at first I still don't think I've quite wrapped my brain around it, because it feels like this guy pays for pretty much anything and everything that Clarence Thomas wants to do, whether it's send his, you know, relative to prep school, or, you know, go on some fancy vacation, or have the Frederick Douglass Bible, or, you know, put new dishwasher in his mother's kitchen. I mean, when you're making whatever the Supreme Court justices make, that's not a lot relative to what a lawyer can make on the open market, but it's not nothing. If you're not spending money on anything else, you can accumulate quite a bit of money. So I guess the first question with that regard is, was this kind of thing like an open secret in DC? Is it something that people knew about inside the workings of things and kind of maybe looked the other way, or weren't sure how big of a deal it was? Or was this totally blindsiding everybody?
I would say that it was certainly not an open secret in DC writ large, or even really within the kind of political community in DC. I do tend to think it was something of an open secret within the kind of cloisters of the Supreme Court. Yeah. And the reason I think that is that, you know, we've seen evidence and sort of unearthed evidence of, you know, a decades long effort by particularly Justice Scalia to circumvent the laws. And there are laws that, you know, constrain this behavior. We should talk about those, because you're right that, you know, there is no enforceable ethics code at the court, but there are federal statutes that apply to these justices, which both Alito and Thomas appear to have broken in withholding these disclosures, that, you know, we should talk about how that, you know, that presents a rule of law problem. But back to Scalia, I mean, Scalia took, we could document, and it was probably many more than this, but we could actually document 85 discrete trips that were hunting trips, often to luxury hunting lodges, often with big GOP mega donors, politicians. He famously took one with Vice President Cheney. People with business before the court. We've talked on previous occasions, Greg, about the trip he took to Germany with gun rights activists, and he received a silver pistol as a gift from the NRA. And, you know, in the kind of casual context of that conference with his gun buddies, he was giving them the outcome of big cases like Heller. He was telling these activists how Heller was going to come down. And so, you know, Given that backdrop, and also given the testimony of a Republican appointed Reagan judge named Mark Wolf, who came and testified in the Senate Subcommittee on Federal Courts recently and really documented his own efforts to bring some of these disclosure issues to light back in 2011, when interest groups on the left had noticed this cozy relationship between Harlan Crowe and Thomas, and Wolf had serious frustrations with the way the Judicial Conference, which is an administrative organ run by Chief Justice Roberts and is supposed to kind of maintain these rules and ensure that they're being followed, had real concerns with the way that the judicial conference was processing those complaints, suggesting that, you know, the judicial conference at the very least, and that's, again, Chief Justice Roberts, was fully aware that kind of this type of engagement was underway with these billionaires providing these travel, these fancy travels without any disclosure.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the laws that are on the books that do constrain the behavior. So first of all, tell us a little bit about what these laws are and how they're in violation, but also what can be done about it? Do Supreme Court justices have to be impeached, or can they just be arrested like everybody else?
They could be arrested like anybody else, you know, and I think there's a real strong case to be made that the Justice Department, based on the facts as we know them, should at least investigate and perhaps pursue, you know, at least civil penalties against these two justices. The law in question, I think the most clearly violated law in question is the Ethics in Government Act of 1978, which applied to, you know, officials across all three branches of government and had, you know, this is a post-Watergate good government reform that extended to the justices explicitly in the text, and that really is at the heart of this disclosure question. Thomas and Alito both claim that, you know, relying on longstanding interpretation by that same judicial conference of something called the personal hospitality exemption, they didn't have to disclose these trips because they were personal hospitality, because they'd been extended as personal hospitality. And that is arguable as to many aspects of these trips, you know, even, you know, the hunting, you know, the hunting lodges, the meals, the wine, all that stuff is arguable. I think you could make a strong case that the judicial conference's previous interpretations were way too lax. Indeed, that position would be supported by the fact that in March, seemingly when confronted with the Justice Thomas allegations, the judicial conference made significant amendments to their financial disclosure rules and their interpretation of that exemption. But there's really no argument to be made that they had any business withholding the private jet travel, because the personal hospitality exemption, and I know I'm getting deep into the weeds of the law here.
No, it's good. We like
really
it.
Really only extends to it, and you can read it in the statute, food, lodging, and entertainment. It does not extend to transportation. And so, you know, this gets at this really bad faith and dishonest argument that Justice Alito put forth in the pages of the Wall Street Journal to pre-butt Politico, where he makes the farcical claim that a plane could fall within the definition of personal hospitality because it's a facility, because we so commonly refer to our flights on facilities.
Yeah, it's a facility.
But really, what he does is he completely and must have been willful. He must have willfully omitted the actual personal hospitality exemption, which extends only to food, lodging, and entertainment, not to transportation.
Well, yeah. To be fair, I mean, I'm sure they showed a movie on the plane. I mean, that is entertainment.
It's true.
You know, how is that different than going to a movie theater,
Alex? Well, you know, you could make the case. You know, you could even make the case that the $500,000 yacht trip that Thomas took to Indonesia with Harlan Crowe, you know, it's not transportation, it's entertainment, right? You could plausibly make that case that it fits within that, you know, absurdly broad interpretation of the law. But, you know, even if that's the truth, right, even if that's the case, and he doesn't deserve to be punished for that under the law, like, it really just calls out for reform, right? We just should not be living in a world where it's acceptable, whether or not it's disclosed, for a person with such awesome power as a public servant to be accepting gifts at that level of extravagance.
No, it's ridiculous. And to be honest, when the news first broke, I mean, you know, my first instinct always is to be like, good, get them, screw these guys. But I really had to stop and think, like, okay, what if they really are friends? What if it's true that they've been friends for all this time and they're just buddies going away and this is how they do it? Yeah, it's just too much. It's one thing if you're going to your friend's house for dinner and they have a nice, you know, wine collection, you don't have to pay for, you know, but yeah. I couldn't, even in my own mind, even giving them any possible benefit of the doubt, it's ridiculous. Because first of all, I don't believe they're friends. If Clarence Thomas wasn't the Supreme Court justice, Harlan Crowe wouldn't give a fuck about him. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say it. Yeah. I don't think he would care. I think that he's friends with him. He is friends with him because he's in eighth grade and he has a swimming pool. It's really that simple. They're friends because of the swimming pool. It has nothing to do with his charming personality or anything else. Yeah. I mean, but again, how do you prove that in court? Well, he's my friend. Yes, he's my friend. I mean,
they admitted they weren't friends until, you know, Thomas became a justice. It was years into his tenure, you know, that was, and it was in connection with a trip on the private jet that Harlan Crowe made available to help, you know, help ease Thomas's burdens of having to fly commercial. My goodness.
Oh my God.
You know, they're also, you know, it's, they're like inconsistent in these defenses, right? We hear from Justice Thomas. No, we're friends. We've been friends for years. Like, what are you going to say? I can't have friends. And then Alito's excuse is that I barely know the guy. So what are we supposed to know? What are we supposed to think about?
I don't think Alito is very smart. I mean, I think that the more he opens his mouth, he thinks he's really, really smart, and he is just kind of not, would be my takeaway from him. I don't know what's going on upstairs there. But I'm very unimpressed with his intellect, and I would like to be, you know, if somebody's going to be, have one of these nine jobs, I would like them to be smarter than me. Cause I remember watching the Roberts confirmation hearing, whenever that was, 01, 02, I forget the year. Was it before? Yeah. And, I was impressed with that guy. I was like, this guy's really smart. I don't agree with him politically or whatever, but he's clearly qualified for the job. Therefore they have to confirm him because he's qualified for the job, you know? And, I don't sense this from Alito. I sense a deep intellectual insecurity that he masks by his bad jokes and, you know, judicial robe. But that's just my opinion.
Deeply held grievance.
Yes.
I mean, this is the other thing about Alito, right? He's just so mad all the time. And if, like, this is what Alito's like when he's winning, God, you know, what would he be like if the shoe were on his foot? I don't know.
Why so mad, bro? So you mentioned before, since we're on the topic of Alito, he wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, which I don't think that's something that justices of the Supreme Court usually do, right? Is that
I'm not aware of any precedent for
that. I can't think of one either off the top of my head. So the guy that runs the Wall Street Journal op-ed page is James Taranto, who's like, he edited a book with Leonard Leo 15 years ago. So this is a guy that's also in tight with these people. And by these people, I mean Leonard Leo and his web. That's Leonard Leo. It's Sam Alito. It's Clarence Thomas. And it's a bunch of other people that most Americans have never heard of. But this guy's definitely, you know, tight enough with these people that it's there. What did you think about it when that came out? Because as you put it, it was a pre-butt for the ProPublica story that was going to break. You know, what happened is ProPublica had the story. At the last minute, you go to the person that you're writing about and ask for comment, and you tell them everything, because this is what journalism does. People on Twitter who do these long threads attacking people don't get comment, don't understand this. But and then he just went and wrote this thing instead. Mm-hmm. It was kind of a dick move, I mean, by any standard. And you know, to pre-butt puts him in the unusual position of having to, I don't even know what my question is here. It's just very bizarre.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's like sort of just a stunner, that one, right? We all just sort of like looked slack-jawed at this screed that he put out there and the very strange decision to do that, right? You wonder if he had any political strategic help or support on it, you know, with the drafting and everything and with the decision to put it out there. I'll start with the Wall Street Journal editorial board. I mean, you mentioned all of their connections to this, you know, web of dark money that has been, you know, entangling our government and our society in the last, particularly over the last 7 years or so. The other connection they have is that four of their members have received $250,000 prizes from the Bradley Foundation, which is one of the biggest vectors of dark money, you know, funds on the entire, you know, right ecosystem. And they're kind of, you know, directly lining the pockets of these editorial board members. It was, I think, a great breach of kind of like journalistic integrity for the journal to do that. They took a lot of flack from their own news staff. I think we're starting to see kind of come out in public, you know, increasingly significant tensions between the opinion side of that paper, which is, you know, increasingly becoming a kind of just a rag for this, you know, frankly, authoritarian movement. And
fascist, the news side, I was going to say.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And the news side, which is still doing pretty good reporting. So certainly, I think it it calls into question the journal's own journalistic ethics. And I think it particularly shines a light on an op-ed or an editorial page publication that was put out before the Dobbs leaked, which seemed to suggest inside knowledge of how that the deliberations within the court were shaking out. There was a leak of the Dobbs deliberations before there was a leak of the Dobbs opinion. And, you know, now that we know that, you know, Alito apparently has a cozy enough relationship with the Wall Street Journal editorial board that he could, you know, swiftly get this thing published before ProPublica had put their piece out. And I think it certainly calls into question whether he was the one sort of alerting the ed board back then to the effort to, you know, move some of the majority votes in the Dobbs case to overturn Roe to a different position, which they were trying to beat back in that piece. And then, you know, finally, the piece itself was just, I think, a masterclass in dishonesty and bad faith from a sitting Supreme Court justice. And it is, you know, beyond the facial kind of absurdity of some of the arguments he put forth, you know, for example, claiming that no reasonable person could think could question his impartiality and sitting on a case where he handed a $2.4 billion victory to Paul Singer after Paul Singer had flown him to Alaska for a private fishing trip. You know, the kind of absurdity of that position, the dishonesty I mentioned earlier of his omission of the kind of true definition of personal hospitality. What I think it really requires us to do is to question whether somebody who's willing to do that in the service of his own defense is really being honest when they, you know, hand down decisions like Dobbs, you know, when they, you know, advance their agenda through these cases where the doctrine doesn't always add up, right? Where the, you know, commitment to textualism, where the commitment to originalism doesn't seem to be adhered to. And so, you know, I think it's really telling that he's willing to engage in this type of legal manipulation in this public context, given, you know, very vocal concerns from, you know, court reform advocates and critics like me about the way that they're, you know, playing fast and loose with constitutional law.
They just do whatever they want, and then they figure out ways to justify it later. That seems to be certainly how Alito works, you know, for sure. He's there. As you said, there's no rhyme or reason. There's no consistency. It's just about, this is something we want, therefore we're going to say stare decisis. And then if it's something we don't want, then stare decisis is, I don't know, the name of a nightclub or something. We'll just go there for drinks after the show, you know. I want to get back to the leak of Dobbs for a second, because this is interesting. Now, did the Wall Street Journal break that story? Is that what happened?
No, they didn't. That was a Politico scoop.
Okay, that's what I thought. Okay. So, but yet, there's supposedly this internal investigation. It leads nothing. And then again, we have this, he's in the ecosystem where there's a lot of PR people. There's a lot of publicists in Leonard Leo's dominion that he's really, really tight with. And not to say or even suggest that, you know, Alito is the guy or that he's using these people or anything like that, but it would be really easy for him to do that if he wanted to. What would be the purpose of him, of the right leaking that, hypothetically?
So the theory of a leak from the right would be that, you know, there was potentially some softening of support for what was at some point a majority opinion, you know, a majority block in support of that opinion, right? And, you know, if somebody like Alito were concerned that he was losing support, as that Wall Street Journal editorial page piece suggested there was, they described an effort by Chief Justice Roberts to try to convince Kavanaugh to come more toward the middle. What Roberts wanted to do was sort of incrementally erode Roe using the Casey standard, whereas Alito just wanted to rip the mask off and end it there. Putting the opinion out in the world would make clear to the people, particularly the people on the right, who, you know, very much prioritized ending Roe as a condition for supporting these justices.
Right.
Putting that out in the world would create enough blowback that they would, you know, no longer be soft in their support for that position. And if that was, you know, if that theory, you know, has any truth in the world, if that was the, you know, if that's what happened, then I think we know how that worked out.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was Kavanaugh and Roberts were the two kind of wishy-washies that came over, or is that what happened?
Well, Roberts never came over. Roberts stayed in his position.
Okay, that's what I thought. Yeah.
He would have upheld the ban, but he would have done it on a different legal basis. He wouldn't have overturned Roe.
Okay.
I think the reason he wanted to do that, I can't read his mind, but, you know, I think we know that Roberts, and we see it in this term's decisions, has, real concern for the court's public stature, its perceptions of legitimacy. And I think he's really eager for it not to be seen as, you know, driving headlong into the abyss in terms of kind of moving a partisan agenda. And I think he thought, you know, we can accomplish many of the same goals, you know, really eliminating abortion in this country if we do it incrementally by using this Casey undue burden framework rather than just overturning Roe outright.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. He's like, yeah, guys, we have to be really, you know, really careful about going down, down, down into the abyss. Meanwhile, he's basically in that Titan submersible at this point in this vast ocean of corruption. So yeah, all right. So this thing, again, this is all hypothetical now. Hypothetically, the right leaks this thing to hypothetically get the wheels turning for people. And Kavanaugh's hypothetical bookie calls him and says, "You better play ball." I kid. I'm joking. I'm just joking. But this is, I want to talk about Roberts. So this is a good point to take a short break. We'll be right back with Alex Aronson.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money that'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler,
how much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary.
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, "Show me, in a courtroom, how we were at war."
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing on the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, "If I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized."
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.
Okay, we're back with Alex Aronson. You brought up Roberts. Roberts to me is sort of fascinating because I mentioned before, I really thought he was cool coming into the job. I was like, this guy's smart. He's with it, you know. And I think he's not smart, but I've been very disappointed with him lately. Certainly in the Trump era, with, you know, that impeachment was a fucking joke. I mean, he had a lot of, I think he had a lot of leeway to make that impeachment hearing whatever he wanted it to be. And as I saw it, he wanted to just sit on his fucking phone and play Candy Crush or something while these idiots were talking to defend Trump. And it turned it into more of a joke than it should have been. And I blame him for that, because he's the one, he could have been the grown up in the room and he chose not to. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering about, like, how much power does the Chief Justice have to set, like, the agenda and stuff like that? Because you put out a tweet today. Today, by the way, is Tuesday. It's June 27th at 7:30 at night. So if anything weird happens after this, it's not our fault. You put out a tweet, and in the tweet, you said something like, the media is always talking about balance in the court and achieving this balance, but they manipulate the docket and they control what's on the docket, and meaning, you know, what cases get heard. Who controls that? Is that only Roberts? Is it all of them together? Like, how much power does he have to push this agenda? Because I think it's a lot, but I might be wrong. I don't know.
Yeah, I would say he has a lot of power, and then there's contexts in which he just doesn't have much more power at all than his colleagues.
Okay.
And picking cases for cert is one of those latter contexts. He has no more power than his colleagues to choose which cases the court hears. The way that the court decides which cases to hear is that when petitions for certiorari come up, because of course the Supreme Court has discretionary jurisdiction in the vast majority of cases. There's some few cases that have what's called a regional jurisdiction when it comes to the Supreme Court. But in the vast majority of cases, they have discretionary jurisdiction, and they use the certiorari docket to pick and choose which cases they want to hear. And the point I was making simply in that tweet was that kind of when we look at, you know, and usually when the media looks at kind of how the court is doing, whether it's, you know, going really far right or really, you know, or, you know, not going far right or staying balanced, they'll sort of like tally the cases, right? They say, oh, in this voting case, like we, you know, recently the court decided the Allen versus Milligan case, and they decided that for, you know, for voting rights, right, to not allow the further erosion of the Voting Rights Act. And so that was sort of hailed as this great civil rights victory. But really, it was just a preservation of the status quo,
right?
You know, and then they'll pick it. And when they move the law, when the conservatives win in the case, the law almost universally moves to the right. Very, very rarely at this point does the law ever actually move to the left. There's a few exceptions, right? The Bostock and Obergefell LGBTQ cases are probably the most notable of those. But so, you know, the sort of, there's a steady march of law to the right, and by their, through their ability to literally craft the docket of cases that they will decide, they can sort of manipulate the way the world sees their output, right? Because they can choose a bunch of cases, like the case they decided. I know it's not the day that your listeners will be listening, but you know this week today they decided the Moore versus Harper independent state legislature theory, knocking down that crazy theory, right. And they're getting a lot. They're being hailed in the media for kind of vindicating the, you know, America's electoral system, but they didn't have to take that case, right? It presented a facially absurd and frivolous theory, dangerous theory. They could have just rejected it, right? They could have, turned it away, and they wouldn't have enjoyed the headlines that they're getting today. So I think that's very much part of their calculus in considering which cases they want to take. You know. Playing that media game. And that's a cynical take. I think a lot of people would reject that view.
I don't know. I think it's a pretty good view, because, you know, again, there is that. And as you say these things, I'm thinking about it, and you're right. It never or almost never moves to the left. It always is, at this point, it's an erosion of rights rather than expansion of rights for people. And what's the name of the case that was today? I wrote it down, and now of course I can't find
it. Moore versus Harper.
Yes. I'm reading that these things are like, okay, this is fine, but this is the one that Ellie Mistel said, it basically makes Bush v. Gore the law now, where, okay, the legislatures can't mess with the elections, but the Supreme Court kind of can. Is that accurate? Is that?
Yeah, they still absolutely can. And I'd commend to your readers a piece that would have aired this week in Slate by Rick Hassan, who talks about the kind of very looming real threats that this case leaves open for mischief and meddling by the Supreme Court in the 2024 election. I mean, I think it's, you know, indisputably a very good thing that they rejected the independent state legislature theory. It's a wackadoodle theory that would have, you know, completely removed state Supreme Courts from their ability to enforce their state constitutions to check these increasingly extreme state legislatures. So that's great that that's gone, but they've left a huge amount of room for themselves, as they so often do, to come in and be the final decision makers.
Yeah. And I feel like there's a sneakiness about it. Like you said, like that we're going to do three things that are little, that make it seem like we're not terrible. And then whammo. They hit you with the lightning bolt.
Yeah.
But,
and you know, I think it's important to note, we've got, you know, proof, we've got evidence of the transactional nature of Chief Justice Roberts's decision making. The best example of this is in the ACA case, the big case NFIB versus Sebelius, where, you know, amazing investigative reporting discovered that he traded his vote to uphold the law, the signature law of the Obama presidency, on this very narrow tax clause ground. He was willing to do it on that narrow tax ground, but not to uphold the power of Congress to pass that law under the Commerce Clause, which is, you know, and in doing that, he really advanced the conservative legal movement's decades-long campaign to really weaken the Commerce Clause. And so the reporting really shows you, there's some other details to that horse trade with Kagan, but it really shows you the sort of transactional and really cynical nature of the way Roberts does not call balls and strikes, but, you know, reaches outcomes that both comport with his own policy agenda and meanwhile keep public perception of the court in a safe enough place for them to continue to do their work.
Yeah. And a safe enough place. Thank you for explaining that, because I think that's helpful. The safe enough place is interesting, because I feel like people really are much more aware, certainly since Dobbs, of who these fuckers are now, and yes, which ones are the bad ones and which ones aren't. And, you know, we have now situations where there's protests in front of people's houses. People down the street from Kavanaugh came out, you know, his neighbors and stuff like that. There's protests in front of Leonard Leo's, you know, one of his main estates, on the anniversary of Dobbs. And I think in the media, they're getting blasted. You know, Thomas and Alito in particular are getting hammered.
Deservedly.
But do you think that this has effect? Is the pushback working, I guess? Because it feels like maybe it is, but I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a reasonable case to be made that some of these pullbacks that we've seen this term, particularly in the voting rights case, because, you know, in the voting rights context, and you mentioned sort of being impressed with Roberts, he's an impressive character, right? He's had this kind of brilliant career. He is a brilliant person. At the same time, he's a reactionary in my view. He came up in the Reagan Justice Department developing the theories to gut the Voting Rights Act that he ultimately implemented in his, you know, notoriously shameful Shelby County decision, which was decided 10 years ago, a couple days ago, and which has really, you know, which really gutted the Voting Rights Act and has led to this assault on minority voting that we're seeing throughout the red states. So, you know, I think it's just, you can't lose sight of who these people are, no matter what kind of face they show you.
Yeah, important. And in his defense, like, you know, the Republicans won't win any more elections if they can't keep the voter suppression up, because they're not popular and their policies are not popular among the majority of American voters. And, you know, and the Supreme Court policies, even less so.
Right, right. We've heard, you know, right-wing activists, you know, state that, admit to that, right? In leaked tapes, for example, the head of Heritage Action talked about how this was a strategy to help Republicans win elections, voter suppression, that is, right? Because they understand that as long as people are voting, they're going to be losing.
Yeah. And instead of just changing their damn, I never understand these right-wing billionaires. I mean, the billionaires are almost always right-wing, but spend so much money on all this crap just to make everyone's lives miserable. Just take that money and just pay your fucking taxes. Like, why is this so hard? Why do we have to be? And it's usually second generation wealth that does this. Have you noticed that? It's never like the founding. Really. It's usually like, hey, I inherited mommy and daddy's money. I don't want the government to take it because I'm a libertarian, because I pulled myself up by my bootstraps, my gold-plated bootstraps, and therefore, fuck all, you know, it's so dumb to me. I don't understand.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think the thing is, Greg, these people are living such just grotesquely different lives than, you know, anybody, any of us, that it's hard to put ourselves in their shoes, right? It's hard to imagine what the world looks like from the perspective of having, you know, inherited billions of dollars and the kind of resentments and grievances that stews in you to have that kind of privilege.
It must be, I don't know. You know, they say money can't buy happiness, but wouldn't you want to test that theory? No, I'm kidding. So I have a couple more questions, because we're, you know, I want to make sure that I don't keep you too long. All right. So Leonard Leo, who's my bugbear, because like me, Leonard Leo is an Italian guy, a Gen X guy, grew up Catholic and from a public high school in New Jersey. And he's not even that much older than me, which always doesn't ever fails to blow my mind. What have I been doing with my life? That I haven't controlled the courts. You know, what am I don't understand.
Are you trying to overturn Vatican II?
I want to bring back Vatican III. I prefer the original to the sequel. No. So have you ever met him, Leonard Leo?
I have not met
Leonard. Okay. That was my question. So what's your take on him? Because he's such kind of a fascinating figure. Although I think he's probably boring as fuck in real life, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, he really seems to be Where's Waldo in these corruption stories. He keeps popping up, right? He's the guy that connected. He's there in the painting with Harlan Crowe and Thomas hanging out at the hunting lodge. He's the person that connected Alito to Singer and sort of made that, you know, that little arrangement happen. He's really been at the center of it. And I mean, his story is that he, you know, when he graduated from Cornell Law School and came to DC, he, rather than kind of embark on a legal career, he really, at Justice Thomas's advice, frankly, that he's talked about this, decided to go to the Federalist Society and focus on network building and power building. And that's what he's been up to. He's been behind the scenes as the executive vice president of the Federalist Society, which is nominally a kind of ideological hub. They call it a sort of a debating society for conservative lawyers, but to my mind really has served as an effective front for a very powerful, hugely funded political network that Leonard Leo coordinates. He's stepped away from his paid role at the Federalist Society. He's still the co-chair of their board. And, you know, from his perch there, he has sort of orchestrated a very complex and, you know, well-coordinated ecosystem of kind of different politically useful organs to infiltrate, capture, and influence the law through the judiciary. And he's become really wealthy in the process of doing this, particularly in recent years. He's had a leading role in the leading role in the selection of many of the Supreme Court justices. He did this strange thing during the Trump administration of kind of taking a leave of absence from the Federalist Society to advise the Trump White House. I think it's decently likely that they broke some laws in his doing that. But, you know, particularly since the Trump administration, he's leaned heavily into this consulting company, which has been taking in just huge amounts of contracts from a lot of the groups that he has helped form. And so, you know, through he's been able to self-enrich and build just a huge amount of power and influence within the government, you know, over the course of his decades of doing this.
I read that the other guy, what's his name, Calabresi, the other founder of the Federalist Society, wanted to put a little bit of distance there. I think probably, you know, sees the writing on the wall maybe a little bit. I don't know if there's a rift as much as a, you know, let's make sure that we're not all involved with whatever it is you're involved
yeah.
with.
Yeah, I have met Calabresi. It was on a Zoom call, and he spoke to this a little bit. He said that there were some within the Federalist Society leadership that did have misgivings about the extent to which Leo was engaging in politics. And so, you know, he didn't say much more than that. But, you know, you can see why, right? This is an organization that had established, I think, a pretty mainstream, credible brand, had a lot of kind of big corporate donors, in addition to its huge billionaire dark money donors. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as Leo and as the Federalist Society became more and more entangled with these very toxic and dangerous Trump nominees, I think there was starting to be some resistance within the organization, which may have been why he stepped off out of his paid role.
Yeah. And then he goes to the work for it's interesting. If you look at the late stage Trump campaign, like post, like around the time of the insurrection, like, you know, November, December, January, the only people that remained were either like flat out crooks or people that had some connection to the Catholic Information Center, Leonard Leo hub. I don't know. Just an interesting observation that I made. Not sure why. It seems very Machiavellian, like ends justify the means kind of shit with these people. Where they just are like, yeah, I know Trump's evil, but, you know, we have to get our judges in there.
That seems to me to be their total governing philosophy, right? Like, it's justify the means. The means at this point are kind of like ending American democracy.
Yeah.
Their ends of theo-fascism justify that.
Right. It's like in the original Crusades, you know, you were allowed to kill people. You got, you know, forgiven in advance if you advanced on the Holy Land. And if you went back and looked at what happened, nothing about it was very upliftingly holy by any stretch of the imagination. But there was that perception. So, you know, I guess everybody's souls were cleansed or something like that. I don't know. What he's putting an awful lot of faith in the Almighty being just exactly the way that he thinks it's going to be. We'll see. No, actually, you know, we won't. Maybe he will. Two more, or actually three more quick questions. Who's the best of the Trump nominees that are on the Supreme Court? Because it seems to me that it's Amy Coney Barrett. That seems to me, reading the tea leaves, and I'm not a lawyer, I don't really read any of this stuff or get it that much. I feel like she's smarter than the other two. What's your take on that?
I mean, I don't look at like whether these folks are smart as all that virtuous. To me, like, the stupider they are, the better, you know, given what I know they're after.
Okay.
I don't think any of them is like stupid. You know, I don't think that any of them is also like, you know, the pinnacle of, you know, jurisprudence. We don't have any like judge friendlies in this crew, but no, I think Barrett has, you know, Barrett voted to overturn Roe versus Wade. Very clear, right? She voted to create a new constitutional right to dark money that has no basis in the text, has no basis in the history that they claim to care so much about. She should have recused from that case. It was a Koch brothers case that Americans for Prosperity brought. While the case was pending, they spent more than $1 million to try to get her confirmed. She should have recused. I have a lot of concerns about Justice Barrett. And, you know, I think at the same time, Justice Gorsuch, as much as I disagree with him, he's shown some flashes of decency on the gay rights issues, on the tribal issues.
Yeah, the Native Americans.
You know, I don't think any of them is like completely straightforward. Kavanaugh has issued some votes, you know, including this term, that haven't been too bad. But, you know, he's somebody that perjured his way onto the Supreme Court repeatedly. And so I just don't hold any of them in very much esteem, given what it took to get them there and what they've done and kind of where I, you know, very strongly believe they're heading.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Kavanaugh, we've resisted talking about Kavanaugh for this whole time somehow.
Yeah, we keep resisting.
I don't want to get into him because I've gotten into him enough, Lord knows. But
yeah,
my main question is, because this comes up, I have my hashtag Who Owns Kavanaugh. My friend Stephanie Koff wrote the pieces about Kavanaugh, the 5-part series years ago now, outlining all the issues with him with this money and all this stuff, and the red flags that were there and the op on, you know, all the Dr. Ford stuff. Mm-hmm. What puzzles me, and the thing that I get pushback from when I say it, is he isn't required. This is the argument that I hear from people on Twitter who I like and trust. Mm-hmm. He isn't required to say who gave him the money to pay the down payment or who paid off his debts if that person is in his family or in this like small thing, which is fine. I actually myself believe there's probably a 95% chance that the person who paid off Kavanaugh is his dad, because his dad, mm-hmm, the year before he got there, got like some $14 million golden parachute buyout. I'm sure his mortgage is paid off. He doesn't have any other kids. His grandkids are living. Like, it makes total sense that he would be like, here's your down payment, have at it. You know, and I don't care, but why didn't he say so? That's the thing that puzzles me, because if it's true, just tell us. Right. If it's not true, what's the point of, does he just not want to further perjure himself by lying and saying it was his dad? Or I don't know. What's your take on that? It's just something doesn't sit right with me there.
Yeah. And we did ask him about this, right? Although I don't think he was ever, you know, questioned publicly about this stuff. Senator Whitehouse did include questions for the record, written questions that got at some of this. And, you know, our best read of his very cagey, extraordinarily cagey answer was the same one you made, that it was likely a gift from a parent. And, you know, why wasn't he more forthcoming? You know, I think they both parties to a certain extent, but particularly the Republicans, have started to take to look at these nominations hearings and proceedings as like an adversarial process where you don't give an inch. And, you know, I think that certainly after the kind of charges were leveled against Kavanaugh around the many, you know, the numerous sexual assaults that he seems to have committed, I think there was just a very defensive, very kind of batten down the hatches mentality about the questions, you know, which were grounded in facts, you know, and asked in good faith. You know, that the senators were asking. So that's my best read. And I think, you know, ultimately at the end of the day, he only has to answer what he needs to answer to get confirmed. And so they had an inside line to the Collins office. I'm sure they knew what they needed to do to get her vote. And once they had her vote, the game was done.
Yeah. Yeah. So I feel like it's just trolling at this point with this guy, or he's, you know, he's just fucking lying. I also think there's a 0% chance that he was not on that Kaczynski guy's dirty joke email list.
Zero chance.
Yeah.
Zero chance.
He's exactly the target audience for that.
Yeah. He said he didn't recall, but I mean, if he was on it, which again, zero chance he wasn't, he would have received like hundreds of sexually explicit emails from that judge.
Yeah. And probably laughed about them or put it to spam. I don't know. Maybe he knows how to do that. Okay, last question. The court now, I mean, it seems like it's veering. It's so corrupt that it's veering towards illegitimacy. We don't want that. What can we do? We need to expand the court. Do we need to have term limits? Do we need to, and how can we get any of this stuff done? When Senator Whitehouse was on my show here, Prevail, he said, mm-hmm. there's not enough public appetite for this. People don't care yet to expand the court. So, are we there because of Dobbs? Like, what do you think we should be doing?
Yeah, I think we need to be working hard to call attention to the corrupt scheme that succeeded in capturing the court and to how it's damaging Americans' lives. Everybody that cares about this needs to talk about it as much as they can. We should infuse it into our politics. We should make clear to our elected leaders that this needs to be a priority. Because if it's not dealt with, then this court will continue to, you know, issue its rulings for the wealthy few, the billionaire backers that send them on their fancy trips. It will continue to issue rulings that take away our rights and freedoms. And so right now, there's a huge gap, in my estimation, between the outrage among the people at the level of corruption that we see on offer at the court and the amount of pushback that they're getting from our elected leaders, right? It's been a few senators that have led this fight. Senator Whitehouse is probably foremost among them. Senator Wyden is doing great work in the Finance Committee. Even Senator Durbin, who has, I think, been really reluctant to engage in this fight, has at least, you know, been moving it forward. I think we need a lot more from them, right? We're in a crisis. The presently composed Supreme Court presents a crisis of democracy, and we need an appropriate and proportionate answer to that from political leaders that believe in democracy, right? So when we had an attack on our Capitol that went to the heart of democracy, the House convened the January 6th committee and told that story and made the case to the American people through highly produced and very effective hearings and real investigation into what happened to make sure that something like that never happens again. We need to take a similar approach with this court, and we need to investigate the corruption. We need to expose the activism in its opinions, the lack of principle. We need to expose and investigate and talk about what Leonard Leo is doing through his, you know, his apparatus of judicial influence. You know, he's got dark money flooding our universities and schools to produce the content, the intellectual capital that becomes constitutional law at the Supreme Court. We need to understand much better how that, you know, connection works. You know, then we need to demand real accountability. I think the Senate should, because they're the ones with a Democratic majority right now, should come together and advance a, you know, strong, ambitious ethics and anti-corruption package, an anti-corruption and accountability bill. Sheldon Whitehouse has a very strong one that I helped develop with him. I think other senators in the caucus have good ideas and should be brought into that conversation. And that Democrats should lean into this fight, because if they do, and that bill would be popular, right? You know, things to put in place an enforceable ethics code, recusal standards, to get dark money out of the judicial process so that we can see who's funding amicus briefs, to perhaps put restrictions on receipt of gifts at the level of the $500,000 yacht. I mean, I know, God forbid. Clarence Thomas not get to take $500,000 yacht trips. But, you know, if the Democrats could come together and advance a package along those lines, it would poll at like 75%. Yeah. And the Republicans would obstruct tooth and nail. And I think it would be highly clarifying for the American voters to understand both the nature of the threat that the court now presents to all of our values, right? Progressive and Western liberal values, not just progressive values, but sort of like the foundational values of our democracy. And we could build momentum to actually constrain it. And you know, whether it's passing a law like that at the end of the day, or, you know, building sufficient political popular power that the court, people like Roberts and Kavanaugh and Barrett, who want to continue to advance their agenda in their from their, you know, comfortable perches on the court, can see, like, you know, we're going to have to respond to this, or else people are just not going to listen to us anymore, because they can see that, you know, our decisions are corrupt, that they're the product of this corrupt scheme. And so that's kind of what I think we need to be doing. And we need to be working together, and we should not be despairing, right? We need to engage in our democracy if we want to have a chance to save it.
That's great. Thank you. I needed that. That was a nice dose of practical advice. And yeah, the Democrats should be doing this. It would be popular. And tying it into the Dobbs decision is the way to do it from a PR standpoint. 100%. Like, hey, this is what happens when this happens. You know, your rights
and
get
remembering fun. Right. And remembering that, like, that wasn't law, right? That was like just deliverance of a promise. That was, you know, that was Trump saying, anybody I pick to the Supreme Court is going to overturn Roe. And then they did, because he promised they would.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the only things he promised that came true, unfortunately. Yeah. So this was terrific. So where can we find you? Your Twitter is what? It's just your name. Is there an underscore?
It's
in
my
there?
Name, Alex Aronson. Yeah. I don't have too much of a public thing, but yeah, Twitter, I tweet occasionally. Sometimes I'll have like Twitter bursts.
I like when you have Twitter bursts. Yeah.
Particularly when right wing, you know, trolls defending Justice Thomas, surely on the take. Start to spout bad faith arguments. I like to tangle with them.
That's good. Oh, you're a better man than I. thank you so much for taking the time today. It was great to see you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Greg. Good to be with you.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fawcett. Zarina Zabriskie, Marie Cost, and Martha Acuna provided the introduction in Ukrainian, French, and Spanish, respectively. Voice talent is by Stephanie St. John, Tally Briggs, Michelle Cantor, and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kenai Williams, and everyone else at MSW Media. Please subscribe to the Prevail Substack with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $5 monthly subscription funds the column and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely. Don't forget to tip your server. And until next time, we shall prevail.
MSW Media.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.